Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about some things about reverse engineering tools, mentioned, you know, that the debugger support features that, you know, can be useful for reverse engineering that you might not have seen before. We mentioned, like, we have watch points, sort of dumping and searching memory for things, and features like that, which, you know, probably in a typical program debugging you haven't encountered, but, you know, can be particularly interesting for debugging when you have an unknown program you want to figure out what's going on. And then we did our case study of the Vienna virus, kind of as an example of this problem of viruses, of malware that embeds itself in other programs, you know, which was a sort of very common for strategy in the early days of malware because, well, this was an easy way to distribute the malware because people were copying programs a lot. And because this is also kind of a stealthy way to distribute malware that's like somewhat hard to detect. And we're going to go into thinking about the things Vienna and similar viruses did, what are our strategies for detecting this, and, well, what are the malware authors going to do in response to that, and, you know, where do we end up? So questions about things we covered last time? And I'll take some time. So as some of you know, at least, we have the RE2 assignment out, questions on that. So that assignment has two parts. The first part, we have a mystery program we want you to sell. Tell us, you know, what does it do? And also, like, what's a bug in it? And we have a part B, where we have a modified version of a database engine, which has some sort of backdoor, where it will execute something, and we want you to tell us, how do you reach that backdoor? Yeah?
For the modified SQLite executable, are there multiple ways to get to the goal label, or is there kind of like an intended path?
Question for the modified SQLite executable, are there multiple ways to get the goal label or there's an intended path? I don't think I can answer that question. We don't care, like, you know, we don't care exactly what your solution does.
Are we allowed to patch the binary?
No. No, it must be an input I can give to the program. But other than it being an input to the program, that's good enough. But, so, that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. So, to start out today, we're gonna look at things that aren't Vienna, that are viruses, and also like thinking about how do viruses work when we have to deal with some realities of modern executable formats, which aren't going to be as simple, and what those other options were. And so Vienna just said we're going to put it at the end of executables, we're going to search for executables by looking for COM files, and there's some other options about where these virus-type programs might insert code. And this can include both putting them in different types of files and also adding the code in a different way to files that might avoid detection better or be more robust or something like that. And, you know, I have a list of a bunch of possible options here. We'll go through them. Some of these are simple. Some of these seem non-intuitive. Like that they're possible. Like possible at least consistently enough that that there'd be a piece of malware that used this strategy, but they all are. So one idea is replacing the executable code. If you don't really care about being stealthy, you can just, you know, overwrite the executable with your malware. And you might say, no one would do that. That surely, wouldn't, be a thing something would do. But this famously has been a strategy some malware use, and it's pretty bad because it breaks the systems that it's on. But in 2000, there was a worm. So this is self-spreading malware that spreads copies of the program that infected programs by replacing files with a copy of itself. And it spread via email, so just primarily via email, but it embedded itself in executables to persist on the system. And probably a big part of why they use this strategy is that this worm was written in Visual Basic. They weren't dealing with machine code or assembly at all. So they used a strategy where they didn't have to think about machine code or assembly to do their infection. Now, you can use this same technique in some malware has, and do it in a more subtle way, where you can just embed a copy of the original executable in your infected copy, and rather than jumping to it or anything like that, you just copy it to a temp file and run the temp file. So you can refine that to be more subtle, and this again has the advantage that the malware author didn't think about machine code or anything like that, or executable formats. All they're doing is just copying the original executable somewhere and running it when they finish running their malicious code. We saw the strategy Vienna used of putting it after the executable code. And kind of the general version of this is we put it after the executable code, to make the executable bigger, and insert a jump somewhere earlier. Now, a challenge with this is that most executable formats aren't like COM, where if we make the COM file bigger, it means more stuff is loaded into memory. With most executable formats, we saw we have a header, like we saw in ELF, that says how much to load in that. So to actually implement this strategy on modern executables, the malware would need to either add a new segment, a new load directive, or whatever the equivalent is in the executable format, or update the last segment to have a bigger size in order to load their appended code consistently. So this is a little more tedious because now you have to write a bunch of code to deal with how those load directives and all that are stored in the executable format, which you can just look up. But it's a lot more work than what Vienna had to do. Another option, and one that was pretty common, is putting it in unused executable code. So something you'll notice about sort of all these strategies here is that these have non-subtle changes to file sizes and things like that. If we can just replace unused code, that keeps the file sizes the same. But there's a question of why would my executable files be sitting around and have unused code in them? Isn't that a waste of my disk space? And maybe it is, but there's typically a bunch of unused code in various places in executables. So one example is that there's these little bits of unused code, these things that we'll call cavities. So for example, this is in LS. We can see we have a jump, and then we have this no op, which is unused code. It's not reachable. There's no way to get there. And this other no op after a jump, this no ops after a return. So there's these bunches of unreachable code that, it's a little small, it's tight, but we could put stuff there and not make the executable any bigger. And this is also a handy thing to note for our, a problem we kind of, skipped over of, like, we want to jump to the virus, where do we insert the jumps? For things like that, this is a natural place to insert that sort of code, a natural way to find space for that code. Yes?
Why are these generated when the code is compiled?
So the question is, why are these generated when the code is compiled? That is a good question, because it seems like this is, like, our compiler being wasteful. And we can find out why, probably. I haven't consulted with the compiler makers and so on. But there's two things going on, I think. So one is, if we look at Intel's manual for optimizing code, and you'll see similar statements in, like, other processor manufacturers' manual, but Intel's manual, I'll just use as an example here, they say, hey, if you're an assembly writer or compiler writer, you should make sure all branch targets are 16 byte aligned. This means that anything you jump to or call should be at a multiple of 16 address. And probably, though Intel doesn't state it very explicitly, this is better for how the instruction cache works, because it means that what's being fetched is in one instruction cache block, and also other caches. It's probably better for Intel's implementation of instruction decoding. This is a good thing to do, and most other processors will have kind of a similar notion that it's better to have things be aligned. There's various things that are more efficient when the addresses that you jump to are multiple. So that explains, like, why we'd end up having a gap here, is that if this is jumped to here, it needs to be at a multiple of 16, and we had these 3 bytes of space left over before we got to a multiple of 16. So, questions about that? Or? Yeah. So, that explains why are these gaps. So, another puzzling thing, though, is why are they filled with no ops? Like, the compiler, the assembler could have put anything there. Why is it putting nops there? Is this just an arbitrary decision? And it's probably on some other platforms, you'd see them filled with other things, like maybe with, like, a crashing instruction or something like that. That would be another option. And if you look at how GCC and Clang, end up generating this sort of code, what they're writing is they're usually writing an assembly directive to, like, align and then the move. So all they're telling the assembler actually is, please make sure this move is at a multiple of 16. And the assembler is generating the nops automatically to fill that empty space. So why is the assembler putting in nops and not some other data, since it shouldn't matter? So one thing might be that the assembler wants you to have code flow through in some cases where you use this directive. But even when we know that's not the case, it's probably better for processor efficiency. Again, this is kind of an optimization manual thing. So the Intel manual, for example, says, please don't place data after an indirect branch, a computed jump, because it can cause performance problems, because what they're concerned about is that the processor will try to decode the instructions after the jump sometimes, and if those instructions are complicated, that will make the processor potentially be slower. So this is another optimization thing where the processor designer has told us, please put good, valid instructions that are easy to process in this gap, because when we're decoding instructions, we might look at it and try to use it. So that's probably why they chose to have nops there. Okay, so questions? Yes. So these gaps, they're pretty small. So we probably can't, like, put the whole piece of malware in there, but if we need to have little bits of maneuvering code, or in an upcoming assignment, like, we want space for a jump, we can probably find it in these gaps. There are other types of sort of unused space we can find in executables, many of which are a bit bigger. So one example is in unused space in the dynamic linking data structures and other things in the program headers. I'll use the dynamic linking data structures as a concrete example. So in the ELF format, the Linux executable format, there's this section which gives information for dynamic linking that basically has a list of key value pairs, an array of key value pairs. And quite often, the space allocated for this is kind of rounded, so we actually have a whole bunch of stuff that is never used in there. And the way the dynamic linker works is it goes through these until it sees a null key, and then it stops. So we could just put whatever we wanted there, and no one will notice. And it's very common for sort of executable formats to have space like this kind of left over, because usually modern executable formats aren't designed to like squeeze every single byte out of the file. Like back in the DOS days in the COM format, this was probably a big concern. These days, you know, yes, this is a bunch of space, but it's like way less than a kilobyte these days. We usually don't care about that too much. So it might still look like, well, all these cavities are pretty, these sort of empty spaces are pretty small. So if we have a really small virus, that's good, but if we want to like take advantage of this space for something larger, that seems challenging. So to give a concrete example of how a real virus worked around this issue, we'll look at an example of a virus called CIH. And what CIH did is that when it infected a program, it put its startup code, you know, at essentially the beginning, and then it put a table of the locations of all the cavities it inserted its code into. So it just divided its code among empty spaces in the executable, where empty means unreachable spaces. And then when it actually ran, it would combine those cavities together in memory and run them. And in this way, this was kind of very elegant because they could just like copy a certain number of bytes, not worry about, am I splitting an instruction in two? Do I need to jump between these things? No, they just copy the machine code somewhere else to actually run it. They're storing it in these empty spaces. And CIH, well, it mostly did not use these little cavities. It used some much larger cavities, which come from another quirk of executable files, which was that there's typically a gap between sections / segments of an executable. That we mentioned that we have these sections, that's like kind of our linker information, like we have the text for the code, we have like different types, special segments for like the stubs that call the dynamic linker, and we also have these segments, these things that we load, you know, and often these are kind of rounded in size. And you can see this if you look on Linux at typical executables. So here, if I have my copy of binls, and if I look at the first load directive, it's trying to load a little over 1300 in hex bytes. If I run it in GDB and look at how much is actually loaded, I see that 1400 bytes is loaded. And this is because Linux only supports units of one page, of 1000 or 4096 bytes. for loading things and allocating memory. So we had some rounding going on. And that means that this space after there is actually loaded all the time. And this is actually pretty big here. This is like almost 4,000 bytes. And also, we can only load things at a multiple of a page size, and that means that the next section that's loaded is offset to a multiple of 1000. So we have this empty space, you know, in the executable between these two things that are loaded that is, you know, in theory, not supposed to be loaded, but in practice, it's going to be, even if we don't modify the header, and it's unused space in the executable, and it's kind of pretty big, actually. It's not guaranteed to be pretty big, because maybe we'd get lucky, and this number would be like 13F9091 instead of 13091, but often it is a lot of space. Questions about the spaces between segments and this rounding? Yeah.
Sorry, this was related to the virus you were talking about earlier. It like said on the slide that it loaded the virus segments into memory. But I was like wondering like how did it do that? And then also like where in memory did it store the virus?
So question, how did it do it? So I'm kind of oversimplifying here. So what would actually happen is that our code would be loaded from the executable, right? The executable would be loaded into memory, and then it would allocate new space and copy the pieces over to this new space to make them contiguous. So they were loaded from the executable just primarily because that's how things work. And then they were copied into memory in one big contiguous space to actually run. And this also means we can kind of extend this strategy to do things like compressing the code. If it's like really big, we can uncompress it when we do this process or something like that. Okay, other questions? But yes, I should have gone into this process in more detail. The challenge there is reorganizing. And we're going to have an upcoming assignment that's tricky, where you probably are going to want to take advantage of these holes, these type of holes, to find space to insert code in the executable, and also these types of holes, these types of cavities, to insert code to go to those larger cavities. But this means we have more space to work with than it looks like. So another place that it's common for malware to try to put its stuff is inside operating system code. The operating system runs all the time. It's a good place if you want to get run. And one particular target is with how systems boot. And we don't really cover this formally in any class, even though it comes up a bunch. So my oversimplified view of how a typical desktop or laptop system boots is that the processor gets reset, and it has to start running code somewhere. And we typically haven't run anything yet that knows how to do I/O. So we're going to have some chip on the motherboard that contains some startup code. That's going to be very CPU and motherboard specific. That's going to run first, which I'll call the BIOS or the EFI, you know, something extended firmware interface. And that's going to know how to do some I/O to start loading the OS. But it's not going to typically have the full intelligence to know how like Linux or Windows likes to be loaded from disk. It's going to have a very simplified idea of how disks work, and traditionally, it will instead run what's called a bootloader. So this is typically in a fixed location on disk, or if it's not fixed, some easy to find location on disk. You know that. And this is just code that exists to load the rest of the OS. And this code typically will understand like the actual file system. It will know what OS files to actually load, you know, and do this extra work that's might be specific to the OS we're running. And it's more complicated than we want to trust the motherboard manufacturer with to actually load our OS. And then the OS will get loaded from a bunch of files, you know, that contain the OS code. Typically, this is not just one file, but a whole bunch of files for running both the parts of the OS that run in kernel mode, that are resident all the time, and the parts that run kind of as quote-unquote normal applications, but are part of the OS, logically speaking. Like part of the OS, logically speaking, I mean like the thing which like displays your login prompt might be a program, but you can say that's kind of part of the OS. Because you wouldn't have it, that's not a normal program that you'd run. So we'll start by talking about bootloaders, because this has been a kind of major way that malware has tried to spread, and it's like particularly kind of stealthy and relatively simple to do. And in particular, in the DOS era, back in the 80s and 90s, this was a very viable strategy because it was common at the time to boot from floppy disks. But software would often be distributed on floppy disks. You often would have a computer without permanent storage, only removable storage like floppies. And the system would default to booting from a floppy if possible, if one was present, even if you had a hard drive, typically. And applications were often distributed as bootable floppies. And kind of the traditional bootloader from the DOS era is that the first 512 bytes of the disk, in this case usually a floppy, but also the same applied to hard drives, would be have the bootloader. And also interleaved with the bootloader would be information about partitions, about what types of file systems are on the disk. And the idea of having the bootloader on this beginning of the floppy or the hard drive is that this makes the work of that sort of motherboard-specific code really simple. It just needs to know how to read from the beginning of a floppy or the beginning of a hard drive to boot. It doesn't need to have any other sort of intelligence about how to figure out what to load. And code in the BIOS would copy this into RAM and jump to it. And this code would be responsible for doing actual disk I/O to load the rest of the operating system that we were using. So there were a bunch of viruses that tried to infect bootloaders by basically replacing the bootloader with their own code and then running the real bootloader. So a strategy for doing this is you find some space that you hope is unused on the disk or the floppy, save the original good bootloader there. You put your bad bootloader, your evil one, at the beginning, so it's the one that runs. And then you do some stuff to set up things in memory, and then you go to the real bootloader somehow to actually infect the system, and the stuff you do when you boot might include, you know, infecting other devices or modifying files. So you can do whatever you want to do before the real OS runs. And potentially modify how the real OS loads in some way. How that would work depends on a lot of details about how that OS works. And, you know, you just hope you've put the backup in a place that's not going to be used. You don't really know it's not going to be used. So an obvious problem with this is that this is like a disk you can store files on. So what if someone writes a new file and it overwrites our backup copy? Because our backup copy isn't a file. It's just data in a random place on the disk that the real OS doesn't know about. And it seems like the strategy of this example virus was probably fine. There were some cases where there were parts of the floppies at the time which were usually unused, and that's probably true with modern formats for storing things in hard drives and so on. Like there's space, with the way file systems work that often would be unused that you could rely on, being a place you could put some data and not have it be used. Or you could just take the risk and hope that, someone doesn't find out that writing a file breaks their application and now your malware isn't stealthy. So, so I mentioned that this was what BIOS did. So modern bootloaders are mostly transitioning to something called UEFI, Universal Extensible Firmware Interface. Firmware being the name for that kind of core software deal with the hardware, what would typically be supplied by our motherboard manufacturer. And UEFI is generally more capable than BIOS is, but the same kind of principles apply of infecting, bootloaders that are loaded by UEFI as BIOS, but they're loaded in a different way, so they'd have to be in a different place and so on. Now, another thing which comes up with this new interface being much more complicated, another place we could imagine malware infecting is it could replace the code that's in the chip on the motherboard. This is typically upgradable because sometimes you want to upgrade it. And now that it's much more capable, there's a lot more space to have code that does interesting things. There's libraries you can take advantage of that are already there. And this is like a major concern for dealing with malware. And it seems kind of weird because, this seems like a hard ask for someone writing malware to do. Like it's a lot of work because this code is very CPU motherboard specific. It's not going to be portable. Also, updating it often requires physical access, not always, but often. It sometimes requires a correct cryptographic signature or some way to fool that cryptographic signature check, so something used to be buggy in a check like that. But it's been a strategy of major concern, and there have been a few examples of these being used by people who sell malware for usually government surveillance or do government surveillance, where there are implants that infect UEFI or BIOS by replacing the UEFI or BIOS code with something. And the reason why they do that is that this is very hard to remove. The code is in a chip, the malware is in a chip on the motherboard. If you replace the hard drive, it's still there. Just very non-intuitive for people. And typically the way this sort of thing would work is that the code that's there, that's in this, on the chip, would be primarily there to install malware on the real OS, meaning that when you replace the hard drive with something fresh, suddenly that fresh hard drive now has malware running on it. So questions about BIOS, UEFI? So, this is the concern. We'll talk about kind of one thing that might mitigate some of these concerns, but you know, for bootloader infections and UEFI, first we'll get to talking about infecting the operating system itself. So rather than just infecting individual programs, we can just try to infect things that run normally. So a simple version of the strategy is when we start our system, there's a bunch of programs that are, you know, run automatically, they're part of the operating system. We can just add a new one, name it something that blends in. You know, that's a simple strategy that malware often uses. Or we can choose, rather than infecting random programs, we can choose a particular system program that we know runs all the time and modify that. And another thing we might do is rather than thinking about being concerned with modifying programs, we might say once we start running, we just want to keep running. We don't care about staying on being stored on disk. And our options for doing that are maybe more flexible than what's in disk. So we could just have a background process that runs, but maybe that's not stealthy, right? That if you pull up Task Manager or on Linux you run the ps command, you might see that. So something we could do is we could insert the code into, say, other running programs. We just like use debugger functionality to modify a running program or modify kind of core OS code, you know, that's always running and just put that. And I guess I'd say OS code, this could be like the kernel or normal libraries, or like the standard library would be an example. Insert there. Okay. So that's on sort of. Sort of where we can place virus code. So the other thing that viruses have options in is how to get the virus code to run in the first place. That'll be next topic, but yes.
How does it get placed in there?
How does it get placed in where?
In the OS. How does it have permissions from the beginning?
How does it have permissions from the beginning? So to use most of these strategies, we need to be running with elevated permissions or on a system where those permissions don't matter. So historically, this wasn't much of a concern because DOS didn't have a notion of administrator. You could always access everything. But obviously, this is more of a constraint for sort of more modern systems where there's a distinction between a user with administrator type access and a normal user, in which case you need to somehow get that administrator type access. Does that answer your question? I guess I would say on the permissions issue, the startup program, we can have sort of per user startup programs. So the per user startup program probably doesn't require special permissions. Is that? Yeah. Okay, so let's next talk about, we know we have some options for where we can insert code. Let's talk about getting code to run. And we mentioned one option obliquely when we talked about where we can put our virus code, which is the bootloader. The bootloader just runs automatically when the system boots. And otherwise, we need some more work. And the strategy in Vienna, we mentioned, doesn't really work anymore because, well, kind of modern executables don't start at the beginning in a fixed location. Well, and we have some through that. But let's start with kind of the simplest strategy for a modern executable, which is changing the starting location. So in modern executable formats, we don't just load something and jump to a fixed address like we saw with COM. We load something and we start at an address that's specified in the headers of the executable. So if you insert your virus code at the end, you can just save the original start location somewhere, change the start location to be where your modified code will be loaded, and now you get to run it at the beginning. We can also just modify code that's going to be run anyway. So Viana used a version of this strategy where they modified the beginning of the program, so it's going to be run, but they have to do some extra work here to restore that code later on. So that's kind of annoying. Another example of this, and one that you'll probably use in the tricky assignment coming up, is that if we have a return with some empty space after it, well, we could just replace that with a jump. And we could imagine replacing a jump with a different jump, be another idea. But we can just look for code that does something and have it jump to our code in the middle, and then we just need to arrange to go back. This return strategy is kind of elegant because if we're replacing a return, we just return in our code, and that goes back to where it went. If I was replacing, you know, jump 1234 with jump virus, then I need to have my virus code end with a jump to 0x1234 to have it this be stealthy. And potentially, we could like use this strategy anywhere, like we just replace some random code that's not in the middle of an instruction, and then just restore that code or rerun it somehow later. So automating this is kind of interesting to think about how malware would do it. So in this case, we could probably say, well, if we see this bit pattern here, this byte pattern, that's probably a valid place to put it. But if we want to generalize this, like, it seems kind of challenging. Like, we're going to be somehow inflexible because we don't want to have a full instruction parser in our malware, probably. And we can have, like, weird situations where we can identify there's unused space after a ret, but it's maybe not really unused. It's, like, a floating point constant or something. Probably doesn't happen too often. And I mentioned replacing jumps, so one attractive option might be replacing function calls. So function calls have this nice bit pattern and a nice, and you know, you're being called as a function, so you know how to, go back to the original code. And you can figure out what function was originally called and go there to hide your tracks. And on x86, function calls kind of have this distinct pattern. But kind of the natural thing to do would be to search for an E8 byte followed by 4 bytes and say, oh, that must be a function call. And the problem is there's probably a bunch of E8 bytes that are not function calls. Now, you can make this better by saying those bytes need to be a valid offset that actually goes somewhere, but there's probably still a lot of false positives there. But there's malware which is nonetheless trying to use this kind of strategy. And one idea is that, well, you know, sometimes there's kind of a good hint if you look at where it jumps to whether or not this is a real function call. So, for example, on 32-bit x86, it was very popular at one time for compilers to start all functions with the exact same assembly instructions. This was because they were using this idea of a frame pointer, which most compilers have kind of abandoned, where basically we have a pointer to the beginning of the stack frame for the function, stored in this case, EBP. And we have this code to set that up and save the old frame pointer value. So this was the same every single function. So there's some malware which has said, I'm going to look for a function call. I'm going to check that where it points to has these instructions. If so, it must be a real function call. Let's replace it with a call to me. And then go back to call it, jump back to this where it was originally supposed to go. And if you remember looking at the disassembly for some of our assignments, you might know there's kind of a modern version of this on our Linux machines. You may have seen this NBR64 thing a lot of times. And this is part of a defense against certain attacks we'll talk about later. But it would also kind of work in the same purpose, where you can like say, this looks like the machine code for a function call, and you don't really have any real understanding of the machine code, but you can still figure it out. So something that Vienna did when it replaced some code is that sometimes we replace code that wasn't just nops, where it was not sort of straightforward to just jump back to where it was originally supposed to go. And on a modern OS, if you just try to do what Vienna did, you'll get a seg fault. And that's because code is typically loaded read-only. But this is something you can work around. So for example, on Linux, you can use the mprotect call to make the memory writable again. You just need to know you need to do that. And this functionality kind of exists in OS for legitimate reasons, because if we think of like a JavaScript interpreter, commonly those work by compiling the JavaScript to machine code at runtime. They need to have memory has code that's writable to make that work. So these calls exist on pretty much every OS to support those types of applications. So we talked about running our code by sort of replacing sort of existing code or modifying existing code. Another strategy is to look at dynamic linking information. So for example, on Windows, kernel32.dll is a library, that shared library that pretty much every application uses. And it has a symbol table telling where all the functions are. So something some malware can do is they can just modify that symbol table to point to a copy of their code. And they know what function they modified, they can jump back to it to hide their tracks. In here, like they've just replaced a function they know will be called a bunch of times because it's just a normal utility function that's used all the time. And I showed you this being done with the symbol table. You can apply the same strategy with relocations. So relocations, remember, told us like, we want to fill in the address of put us here. We can just say, we want to fill in the address of evil virus here, please. We can add a library to the list of libraries you need. Just say, yeah, you want to load virus.so. And when libraries are loaded, typically startup code runs to like initialize data structures and things like that. That startup code could be the virus code. And also, we know we have these stubs, and we could replace those stubs with, you know, our own code, and they have a very regular format. So this is something you could pretty easily automate and have a very low chance of getting it wrong. Okay. So that's like our, so this was my overview of kind of infection techniques. And looking at a whole bunch of them, because our next topic is going to be thinking about how do we detect things like viruses and other malware. And one thing we want to think about is like what are we going to be looking for? And well, all these ways of getting the code to run and inserting the code, they're going to be things we want to figure out how to look for, how to do that efficiently, and that'll be our next big topic. Questions about kind of like overview of infection techniques. Okay, so as I mentioned, there's a upcoming assignment where you basically do some infection stuff. And kind of next time, we'll start with this question about thinking about these techniques. Like, we should think about, well, I talked about a whole bunch of ways of getting our code to run, of inserting our code. Which of them are going to be big red flags that we could write software to look for and tell the user, hey, something's wrong here? Okay, so that's where we'll finish up today.